Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Sustainable Finance Podcast. My name is Paul Ellis, and I'm your host for these programs about developments in this fast-growing industry. In this episode, we will explore the evolving landscape of ESG data and metrics in the Asia-Pacific region. With a diverse array of economies, regulatory environments, and cultures, APAC, or the Asia-Pacific region, presents unique challenges and opportunities for ESG integration. Our guests, Gene Lee and Kyle Flick of Novata, will provide insights into how businesses, investors, and regulators in the region are addressing ESG issues, the progress made so far, and the road ahead. Hello, Gene and Kyle, and welcome to the Sustainable Finance Podcast.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah.
Hi, Paul. Thanks.
Glad you can be here with us today. We're excited to be doing this program. We're very excited about finding out more about what's going on in the APAC region. So let's begin our discussion with the current state of ESG in the APAC region. Kyle, what are the most important trends in ESG across the APAC region, and what are some of the misunderstandings?
Sure. Happy to start off and happy to maybe just take a macro view of the situation and hand it off to Jean, as I know she has some more details on what's happening on the ground. So I think at a very high level, obviously there's 50% of the people on planet Earth are in APAC. And we say APAC broadly, but it's made up of a diverse set of countries that is, you know, has been quite fragmented in their sustainability approaches. But as we'll discuss, I think there has been some convergence as of late as to various disclosures and basically driving sustainability at a high level. And so we have 50% of the people in the world, we have half of the world's emissions, and essentially the goals that we've set that you hear in the news and in various media sources of 1.5 degrees lowering the temperature, you know, we've been on a number of events and the battle is going to be won or lost in this area for, you know, for that reason. And so, like we said, there is fragmentation. It's a huge group of countries. But what we're seeing as of late, which is interesting, is there has been some convergence around ISSB, which we'll get into details in a bit. And I think that's really encouraging. And so although there's different approaches into implementing those standards, I think the convergence around those standards is really good. And I think one of the biggest misunderstandings is that APAC generally is behind on ESG. Like, I actually just don't even think that's the case. I think when you look at a regulatory perspective and you actually talk to various investors and companies on the ground, they're thinking about this and they've been doing this for a little while, right? They might not be as loud about it as we see in the US, and obviously being a US focused program, that's where our head is at most of the time. But I actually don't think APAC's behind from an ESG and sustainability perspective. And so I think that's one misunderstanding. And I think another misunderstanding, you know, looking at the US and China, like, China is leading in renewable investment. They're leading in solar investment, they're leading in wind investment. And they have a ton of nuclear reactors as well. So I think those would be my two misunderstandings.
Okay. Yes, I've been reading a lot recently about China's, especially their lead in solar. And they actually, I was reading a story in Bloomberg last week about a company in Ohio that is now joining into, is partnering with a Chinese manufacturer for manufacture and distribution of their solar panels here in the U.S. And the dialogue that's going on around that from a regulatory perspective. So thanks for those opening remarks, Kyle and Gene. What have general partners and portfolio companies been most interested in so far, since Novata, of course, works primarily or exclusively with companies in the private markets?
So there are two ways I'm looking at this in the things that they're most interested in so far. I think the first is the strategy setting and carbon data collection. That's what we hear a lot from general partners. They're primarily focused on establishing a clear strategy for collecting carbon data, identifying material ESG metrics, and ensuring that their portfolio companies are compliant, but at the same time, without being overburdened. So I think this is the key thing, right? It's just making sure that they are not overburdened from the compliance approach. And largely, the interest stems in why they're collecting this carbon data is because there's increasing pressure from their limited partners who are actually frequently scrutinizing ESG metrics due to growing stakeholder concerns. So I think, Carl, maybe you can talk a little bit more about, you know, regulatory, but in countries like Australia, New Zealand, regulatory frameworks around carbon disclosures, such as the Australia National Greenhouse and Energy Reporting Scheme, are actually pushing firms to enhance transparency. And like Carl has mentioned, I think the other parts of Asia Pacific, there are definitely countries like Singapore, Hong Kong, also trending towards getting private companies to have carbon disclosures or climate disclosures, which then is something that general partners are concerned about. And so that leads into what portfolio companies are interested in as well. So they face actually a couple of internal challenges in being able to adhere to what their general partners are asking for. So a couple of things. One is their internal buy-in in both, you know, the commitment and resources and being able to adhere to these requests from their general partners. And actually the second is quite key, which is their expertise in complying to these stringent, I would say, regulations that they actually eventually face or currently face. So I would say these are the two buckets of concerns that general partners and portfolio companies are interested in.
Okay, great. Well, thank you very much for that. And let's move on to the regulatory environment now, as you alluded, Jean. Kyle, can you give us an overview for Singapore, Hong Kong, and Australia?
Absolutely. And I will just preface this by saying I do not have a law degree, but I read a lot about these regulations. So I will do my best, but this is not legal advice. But I will say that I think we've been very impressed as an organization, and I'll focus on Singapore, Hong Kong, and Australia, namely because at the top, I had mentioned that there had been some convergence around ISSB, and that's really what we're seeing. And so we're starting in Singapore. We're looking at these climate-related disclosures being phased in over the next few years. And so starting with large listed companies, when I say listed, think public equities here, and then rolling into large private companies by 2027. And so 2027, you would think, is a long ways away, but 2025 is right around the corner, and which means you have to start collecting data very soon after that. And so I think what's interesting about this is scope three, they're also requiring, and they will be requiring assurance on this as well. So it's not like, hey, let's throw in a couple of data points and call it a day. This needs to be assured by a third party. And so this really shows the seriousness of these regulations. So I think that's really cool. Looking at Hong Kong, similarly, you know, really converging around ISSB S2 climate disclosures and really rolling out that approach for publicly listed companies on the Hong Kong Stock Exchange starting in 2025. Similar sort of concept, slightly different rollout, but at a high level, phased approach, ISSB S2, very similar. And then some of the big news out of Australia, which we saw back in September, I think that legislation was passed in September of 24. And then the first reporting for large companies starts in 2025. And so this applies to large Australian companies based on revenue, assets, and employee thresholds. And for those that are familiar with all of the regs in Europe, this is how they've rolled out some of those regulations as well. And so, you know, this is for both companies and investors disclosing climate risks and opportunities. And these climate disclosures are going to sit next to their financials. And so I think the trend that we'll get to in this conversation and something that I'm really excited about is that vernacular is going to be in the same sentence as your income statement, your balance sheet, and your cash flow statement. And that's really, if you go to a lot of these events and you're talking to a lot of folks on the ground, that's what people want, is they want that connection to their financials. How can they do better diligence to screen these companies? And then how can they work with these companies during the life cycle of the investment and then sell them at a premium at exit? And so we'll get into this, but these phase rollouts are a good example of what's to come over the next 5 or 10 years.
Okay. Now, Kyle, you mentioned a couple of things during your remarks here that I'm not quite sure all of our followers understand or know what you're talking about. When you talk about ISSB, what are you referring to, please?
Sorry. I think it's funny. It's like we do this every day. We just assume that the jargon
I know.
Everyone knows. And it's just not a real thing, right? So the International Sustainability Standards Board. Mm-hmm. And so when I say ISSB, if folks are familiar with TCFD, which is essentially the Task Force Disclosures for Climate, those ISSB basically did all of their climate disclosures based on TCFD's recommendations. And so a lot of what you see in the risk and opportunity framework from TCFD is now rolled into ISSB. So when we see this level of convergence, this is what we've been talking about for years now and have been hoping for, and we're really starting to see the beginnings of it. So very exciting stuff.
Okay, great. Now, and if you could just remind our listeners what scopes 1, 2, and 3 are briefly, that would be helpful as well. Thanks.
Sure. Scope 1 is energy that you directly emit. And so if you own cars, if you own a factory, and you're burning fuel or energy, those are scope 1 emissions. Scope 2 emissions is if you have an office and simply purchase electricity. We're not, if we work in office buildings or co-working spaces, we're not bringing in gas to turn on the lights, right? We're just paying for electricity and or they're paying for the electricity in a centralized way. So that's scope 2. And then scope 3, we sort of think of upstream and downstream activities. And so what are the inputs that you need to make your product? If you make phones, what are the number of materials that are being shipped to your facility to assemble? The carbon emissions from those inputs that get shipped to you. And then when you ship out the produced good, downstream activities to ship to your customers. And so there's 15 categories of scope 3, which can get very complex, which is why a lot of these regulations are starting with scopes 1 and 2 and rolling in scope 3 down the road, because about 80% of companies' emissions are in their scope 3. So as you can imagine, the life cycle of a product is quite extensive.
Okay, thanks for those remarks. Now, Gene, companies are responding increasingly to these regulatory pressures around ESG data and reporting. How is that going in the APAC countries so far?
Yeah, I think what Kyle has shared is just a lot of regulations, as you can see, that companies are struggling potentially to deal with that. And I don't think they are struggling to understand it. I think there is a lot of understanding that goes on in a lot of conferences and a lot of talks. I do feel that if you look at how they're responding to it in APAC, there is a very varied approach in how they respond to it. One of the noticeable trend is the assignment of ESG responsibility within firms that may not have a dedicated ESG lead. So we're not talking about firms that already have an ESG lead, already far ahead in the game, because there are actually quite a number of firms in APAC that already have a head of ESG, a lead in this area, and they're quite progressive in how they address the ESG integration within the firms. So I think one trend was just that firms that do not have that have multi-hatting, if you think about it that way. So roles, for example, where a managing partner or a compliance officer may be tasked to have ESG oversight in addition to the primary responsibilities. So this presents challenges that we saw before that we spoke about expertise, right? The challenge of the lack of ESG expertise. So this approach of multi-hatting, you know, while very pragmatic, it really highlights that there is a deficit in the specialized focus and strategic expertise in this area. So it could, you know, compromise the firm's ability to effectively manage or respond to these ESG requirements or regulations, right? So in fact, I do want to share that in the 2024 Wolters Kluwer Future Ready, I hope I pronounced that correctly, but there is a Future Ready lawyer survey that they reinforce this concern, right? Because there's only 29% of corporate legal professionals, we're talking about law firms, that they feel prepared to tackle the growing demands of ESG-related legal expertise. So this is interesting because it indicates that even among professionals expected to understand regulatory landscapes, there is a widespread acknowledgement of the challenges in actually understanding and managing the complexities in ESG. So I do find that that's quite interesting to see as a trend, you know, and I think this is not just in APAC, right, but everywhere. And when we look at the companies itself, so portfolio companies, we also see a very similar double-hatting trend, sometimes landing on their investor relations or corporate communications lead. So the thing about ESG reporting, you know, when they are looking to adhere to these regulations, it does come with established frameworks and standards. So the emphasis is actually more on the quantitative metrics, accountability and comparability. However, what we've seen so far is a lot of qualitative kind of responses, maybe more of a report, their policies, their approach. So that's some of the trends that we're seeing. But obviously, it's very varied, as I mentioned. So it's just interesting to see how APAC is, you know, it's very hard for us to generalize as how are firms across different countries dealing with it. But these are just some observations, right, that we do see that multi-hatting of responsibilities is going on, and also the variety of regulations are going on as well. So I do find that we are starting to see this trend shift, right? So when you look at portfolio companies or companies, they are beginning to invest in targeted headcount. And, you know, there's much more stronger mandate from some LPs. So if you think about some firms who do want to raise funds in more mature LP markets like in Europe, they do find that, okay, there's more pressure. So they will start to invest in ESG targeted headcount or be more thoughtful about how they're doing their ESG reporting and documentation. And one last thing I do want to touch on is obviously is Novata is a you know, solutions provider. Technology is increasingly brought into this ESG reporting demands because, you know, with the need for transparency, accountability, and the ability to compare data, you will need technology to facilitate this process, right? So there are some firms that we've seen in order to adhere to these regulations, with the number of data that they need to process, they are turning to, you know, technology and expertise that will help them. But, you know, at the end of the day, these require stakeholder buy-in and resources. And we talked about it a little bit before, that it does take a bit of buy-in and the resources. And there's been a bit of a wait and see approach that we've seen across some of the firms in the region. So we do try to advise our, you know, clients when we do speak to them, that given the fast changing trends, to not be caught off guard and actually take some proactive steps. So that would be the message I would definitely share.
Okay, well, that's great. And it's a great lead into the next question, which is for both of you. And that is, what should companies do if their required disclosure date or dates is still a few years out? How can they be preparing for this from your perspective? Kyle, why don't you go first?
Sure. I think not letting perfect be the enemy of the good is a great saying. I think it's like just start collecting things that matter to you. And I would actually say that it'd be hard-pressed to find a company that's not collecting any sustainability data. They probably just don't call it sustainability data, right? And so collect the data that you already are good at collecting. You probably have board diversity data. You probably have some level of hiring policies, right? Every company has these things. So you can start with a few easier metrics and just start collecting, because either your future investors, your customers, they're going to be asking about what you're doing. And then when you actually have to disclose from a regulatory perspective in a couple of years, you already have a lot of the systems and processes in place to do that at a high level, because these disclosures are extensive. There's sometimes 100, right? In CSRD, there is hundreds of data points for a company. You don't want to be doing that your first time around, as that probably is not going to be very fun. Over time, you can tweak your approach. You can add new metrics. You can take metrics away. You can see what your response rates are. You can engage companies in a different way. All of these things we've done with so many clients now, we've seen how it works, that folks like to improve year on year. And so keep it simple, do the things you already are good at, and you're probably already doing.
Gene, any thoughts on that as well?
Well, I do say that, I mean, when I tell my daughter, right, practice makes perfect. So pretty much, you know, just get started, practice on what you need to do, and just figure out what are the gaps. In fact, just taking that step to do a test run, reviewing your ESG data strategy, understanding those gaps, I feel like the first steps to figure out, you know, what you need to do when your disclosure date is a few years out. So although I have to say, disclosure is a form of pressure to get stakeholders and internal buy-in, but the outcome, I think, as Carl mentioned earlier, right, the outcome and benefit from doing this exercise far outweighs this mandatory box ticking that comes with regulations. So I would suggest, you know, speak to a few people, your peers, speak to even vendors and tools, because in doing so, you get to understand your specific needs. You get to understand what your limitations and strengths are for each option. Because, you know, we have seen many firms who, when they speak to us, they go, oh, I didn't know that you did that. So it's simply because they've adopted this wait and see. So they're closed off from what they're exploring, right? What's out there. So I think it's exhausting still, I have to say, but it will be very helpful to figure out what is material for your firm, what's helpful for your firm. And that would help put you in a much better place, you know, a few years later when you need to disclose.
Okay, great. Now, we haven't talked about investors in the APAC region yet. So, Kyle, why don't you take this next one also? Let's bring investors into our discussion, because we haven't so far. And why should they be integrating ESG metrics into their investment decisions now rather than waiting until they're required to do so?
Sure. And I think if you go on the conference circuit that Gene had alluded to, you'll hear a lot of talk about value creation. Sounds like a buzzword. It's really not. There's actually a lot that goes into it. I think there's three things. I think the first part we already touched on, which is sort of the regulatory pressure, LP pressure. They're from firms and GPs that they're already feeling this from their LPs when they're going out to fundraise for new funds. And so I don't think that's a huge surprise. I think the second piece around value creation, like when we talk about sustainability, it's about extending the life of the portfolio company. And there are real world risks like climate, like water shortage, like all of these things that reduce its sustainability, right? That shorten its life as a company. And as a company, you want to extend your company. You extend your company by increasing your cash flows. And so you probably want to look at every metric you can that can extend the life of your cash flows. And I use this analogy really to showcase that, you know, that's really what folks are looking for. And there hasn't been a clear tie yet. But there's one example where data breaches, if you are a company and you have a data breach, it costs $4 million on average for a mid to large, mid-sized to large company. And that's due to losing customers, increased resources, increased legal fees, that sort of stuff. So these are real world costs. If you're a portfolio manager and you have 40 companies and 10 of those companies had a data breach during that year, it's a $40 million line item, right? So these are the types of examples and exercises folks are going through to actually tie some of these sustainability metrics to the bottom line. And then one more example we heard at a conference last week is NSSK in Japan. They actually measure their EBITDA and cash on cash return for hiring more women on the board and management teams. And culturally, Japan has very low numbers in terms of women as chairmen, as CEOs on boards, et cetera, like sometimes less than 1 or 2%. And their portfolio, they increased to like 30 or 40% and had very impressive cash on cash returns for their portfolio. And he shared his spreadsheet, shared his table. This level of detail is what investors are looking for. And so it's not just the regulations, the box ticking exercise that Gene alluded to. This is real value, and these are real numbers that extends the life of your company. And then if you think about it, you want to do that through the entire life cycle of the investment. So when you're raising money as a fund, you want to make sure that you're thinking about these things. When you're doing diligence on a potential investment, you want to have good screening criteria, so you're keeping these things in mind. Or if you buy a company or invest in a company, you can build in a lot of these processes to create value, right? This is what we're talking about. And then ultimately, when you sell the investment, a lot of these things are embedded in the company, usually demands a premium at exit. And so this is the language that investors speak. And these are real world results that we keep seeing time and time again.
Okay, thanks for that. And Gene, from your perspective, what are the biggest obstacles to investors and companies and when it comes to integrating ESG metrics and practices, and where are the opportunities for growth and innovation?
Well, I think Kyle brought it to life in a way that if you are able to successfully integrate sustainability metrics, ESG metrics, there is that real value of building value creation of a premium when you exit. But the primary obstacle is that many investors and companies just don't fully believe that ESG creates quantifiable value. And I think quantifiable is the key word, right? They may intuitively appreciate its importance. We all know this. We all love it. We love the idea of it. But they struggle to validate ESG's impact on financial performance with the same clarity as the traditional metrics, right? This skepticism is often due to very limited historical data, potentially the cause and effect as well, the causality of the success to ESG metrics, which does make it challenging to link ESG improvements to these financial outcomes. So the opportunity does lie in actually addressing this data gap. You know, so according to NASDAQ's 2024 report, 62 companies using ESG software achieve full ROI within 3 years, indicating tangible value from actually structuring this ESG initiatives. So if data gap is an issue, that's limited historical data. So let's fix this data gap issue, right? This suggests that the integration of ESG software not only boosts the data quality, but also demonstrates this ROI over time. So then you bridge the data gap between ESG and traditional performance metrics. So that's the data gap. The other barrier is data consistency. So private companies often lack standard ESG data collection processes. And so many frameworks that we see out there, right? You know, the ISSB is a kind of like a framework, the EDCI, there's just so many frameworks and acronyms out there. They have sought to remedy this issue. So now comes the difficulty in actually harmonizing all of this data when you're using all the different frameworks and the interoperability of all of these frameworks, right? So you want to then also put another layer of whether or not this meets with your financial materiality factors. So how are you going to manage that, right? So this is where technology comes in to help manage this task effectively. So I would say for the opportunities and growth, right, for companies still hesitant to invest in ESG expertise or technology, I'm not saying this just because we're from Novata, but I do say a phased approach, just like what Kyle was saying, regulators have this phased approach. Similarly, you have this phased approach to implementing it is advisable. So begin by running small tests, build some internal capacity for ESG data collection and analysis. Then you can also start to do more qualitative people kind of change management stuff, like running workshops or community events for these portfolio companies to learn from one another and just understand what is needed. And that would help get things started. Someone always told me, you know, if you have a big surgery, you don't do all 10 surgeries in a day, you do them bit by bit. So that's really how I would see it. You know, it's a heart surgery almost.
Yes, I really think that that's so valuable as advice to companies. And I've heard from many companies that are on essentially the Novata's side of the ledger here. When they are providing software and data collection, they tell people in the C-suite, start with the three most important metrics that you can come up with, and we'll get to the other ones after you get good at reporting on these. So finally, let's just talk a little bit about how companies in the APAC region can stay ahead of the curve on ESG trends and regulation. And Gene, why don't you go first on this one? And Kyle would like your perspective as well.
Sure. I think in summary of what we've shared so far, I've said this a couple of times, right? It is essential to remember that we have all these regulations, disclosures that are required. These are just starting points. It is there to motivate action. The real opportunities, I think, for all of us to remember, it lies in embedding ESG metrics in your investment strategy for long-term value. So make sure your process and data strategy goes beyond ticking boxes, and they should be tailored to your firm's needs. So advice, connect with your peers, industry experts, and gain insights on what truly adds value, and then you can get things moving.
Great. Kyle?
I think the one thing I would talk about, doing the test runs, doing a phased approach, I think that's excellent advice. And I think at the beginning, you called me out for the jargon, right? Like, there's a lot of jargon flying around the space. I think there has been a wait and see approach because everyone's like, what is going on? What am I even looking at here? There's a million frameworks. Everyone's saying there's going to be convergence, and there just hasn't been, but it's not going away. We're starting to see convergence among the three regions we touched on earlier from ISSB. And despite the rhetoric around the world about whether ESG matters or it doesn't matter, or sustainability matters or it doesn't matter, we see many jurisdictions in Europe, in APAC, and North America all implementing these phased approaches so that you start reporting sustainability next to your financials. And so it really just is a matter of time. And so I think getting started is a great piece of advice.
Okay, great. Well, Gene and Kyle, tell us where online our followers can go to learn more about Novata's work and the progress that you're making in the APAC region's private markets, and how can they get in touch with you to learn more about the issues that we've discussed in today's episode?
Well, Paul, I'll speak on behalf of Kyle and myself. We are super excited to share that while Novata is headquartered in New York, we recognize the diversity and uniqueness of APAC. So we have a dedicated team based in Singapore to provide support to this region. And so to learn more and to reach out to us for a discussion, you can visit www.novata.com. And when you fill up your details through the Contact Us page, your message will reach us directly.
Terrific. Okay, well, thank you both very much for taking the time out of your evening today. And we really appreciate the opportunity to have this conversation. It sounds like things are moving quickly for Novata over in the APAC countries. And we're going to make sure that anything that you and Katie want to have as attachments to this program are available to people so they can do more research on their own after listening to or watching the episode. Thanks very much for joining us today, Gene and Kyle from the APAC offices at Novata. And I'm Paul Ellis. This is the Sustainable Finance Podcast.